1 Kings 18 and 19. 18 and 19 have an interesting connection. They both are about Elijah, and they really have kind of a launch of excitement and then something quite different. As Tyler spoke last week, I really could see that, I mean, Mount Carmel was like the Super Bowl for Elijah. I mean, he was up against 450 Baal prophets and just one guy named Elijah. And these Baal prophets, you know, were trying to defeat him and vice versa. And the God of Elijah, Yahweh, rained fire down on the altar, and the victory was the Lord's. But really, it's studying 1 Kings 18 and 19, I would suggest that last week was the Super Bowl, but this morning is the toilet bowl. Anyway, that's just a little funny thing. And the idea is that it goes in a surprising direction. I was thinking about this today, about the Super Bowl, and it's one of the biggest events in America. You know that 100 million people are going to watch this game around the world. And the players on these teams are celebrities, and they've reached the pinnacle of their success. And these two teams are like everything. And then, you know what? There's 30 other football teams, and I mean, they're really the losers, right? I mean, they don't even have any reason to live, right? No, it's. See, you can see the contrast. So much of life is going, wow, I've been promoted, I'm succeeding, I'm doing all these great things. And then when something difficult or hard happens, we can really sink down quickly. And so that was a little bit of the contrast from only two teams to 30 teams. But the idea here today is we have a high, a mountain high, and a valley low. And we've already talked about the mountain high last Sunday, and so we get to do the valley low. Now, I want you to think about this. What would you call a guy who prays that it will not rain, and for 3.5 years it doesn't rain? What would you call a guy who's fed by a raven? Ravens, those are birds. And they come and fly and they give him bread and meat. What would you call a guy like that? What would you call a guy who befriends a widow, tells her that not to worry about flour and oil because it'll never run dry, prays to God, and it never runs dry. And then a little bit later, that same widow loses her son, and Elijah comes onto the scene, and what does he do? He prays that he'll come back to life, and he does. And then he's facing all these Baal prophets, and he's on the mountain, and he goes, God, rain down fire, and guess what happens? It does. What do you call a guy like that? Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is not human. It's superhuman. I mean, really, isn't like Elijah a superhero? It would be that feel. So when I read what James said about Elijah, I was sort of surprised. Maybe you would be surprised too. Look what James says in 5:17 and 18. It's on the screen. He says, Elijah was a human being even as we are. And you know what I say? No, not a chance. I'm not even close. This isn't something I can relate to. And then he says, just like we've been talking about, he prayed earnestly that it would not rain, and it did not rain on the land for 3.5 years. Again, he prayed, and the heavens gave rain, and the earth produced its crops. So I'm telling you, it doesn't really make sense to me that James called him human. But I haven't read 1 Kings 19 yet, and maybe you haven't either, because James calls Elijah human because of 1 Kings 19. Are you curious? Here we go. 1 Kings 19, starting in verse 1. Now Ahab told Jezebel everything Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. So Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah to say, may the gods deal with me, be it ever so severely, if by this time tomorrow I do not make your life like one of them. Oh, and you know, our superhero Elijah says, bring it on. No, not really. Verse 3, Elijah was afraid and he ran for his life. What? When he came to Beersheba, 100 miles south of Jezreel, it says, in Judah, he left his servant there while he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness. And he came to a broom bush, but really a tree, about 10 feet tall, not especially great for shade, but that's what he used it for, sat down under it and prayed that he might die. I have had enough, Lord, he said, take my life. I am no better than my ancestors. And what he's saying there is, I'm a real failure. That's so interesting. That's not how I perceived him, but that's how he's perceiving himself right now. Then he lay down under the bush and fell asleep. All at once, an angel touched him and said, get up and eat. He looked around, and there by his head was some bread baked on hot coals and a jar of water. He ate and drank, and then he laid down again. Must really have been wiped out, you know? The angel of the Lord came back a second time and touched him and said, get up and eat, for the journey is too much for you. I mean, to me, it's like the angel is more concerned about Elijah than Elijah is for himself. Hey, you need some nourishment here. So he got up and ate and drank. Strengthened by that food, he traveled 40 days and 40 nights until he reached Horeb, the mountain of God. Mount Sinai, two names for that. There he went into a cave, and he spent the night. All right? It's not how I would have thought things would have gone. This is really surprising. Now, the story continues. Let's see what happens. And the word of the Lord came to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? And he replied, I've been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, torn down your altars, and put your prophets to death with the sword. I am the only one left, and now they're trying to kill me. The Lord said, go out and stand on the mountain in the presence of the Lord, for the Lord is about to pass by. Then it says, then a great and powerful wind tore the mountains apart and shattered the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. Where did it go here? Oh, after the wind, there was an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. Everything shook. After the earthquake came a fire, and Elijah knows something about fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire came a gentle whisper. When Elijah heard it, the idea is he stepped toward. He had been in the cave. And he stepped towards. He finally recognized something happening here. And when Elijah heard it, he pulled his cloak over his face and went out and stood at the mouth of the cave. Then a voice, a gentle whisper, said to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? And he replied, I've been very zealous for the Lord God Almighty. The Israelites have rejected your covenant, tore down your altars, and put your prophets to death with the sword. I'm the only one left, and now they're trying to kill me. Pretty interesting. He says the same thing. Then it says, the Lord said to him, go back the way you came and go to the desert of Damascus. When you get there, anoint Hazael, king of Aram. Also anoint Jehu, son of Nimshi, king over Israel, and anoint Elisha, son of Shaphat, from Abel-Meholam to succeed you as prophet. Jehu will put to death any who escape the sword of Hazael, and Elisha will put to death any who have escaped the sword of Jehu. Yet I have reserved 7,000 in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed down to Baal and whose mouths have not kissed him. This is the word of the Lord. And this is our story today. And so when I think about this story, I think about the contrast of 18 and 19, from the mountain to the valley. That's what I sense happening here. And as I thought about it, I think there's two movements in this chapter, two movements in the story. There's one that's very human, and there's another that's quite divine. Of course, we're going to start with the human, and I'll call it human default. When I use that word, I'm thinking of that automatic preset. The idea of pre-existing tendencies. Are there pre-existing tendencies in us as human beings? I'm obviously saying, yes, there are. And were there pre-existing tendencies in Elijah? That's what I'm thinking. I would suggest something like this. When really good things happen in your life, you and I are prone to go, hey, I'm doing pretty good, living the life. And a sense of pride might creep in. But when things go bad and difficulty happens and everything, we have the tendency, the human tendency to go, oh, life stinks. What a bummer. And feel down, right? That's default. That's what I'm referring to it. So watch what the wise man Solomon said in regard to this. This is what I think is happening. In Proverbs 16:18, the words are, pride goes before destruction, a haughty spirit before a fall. So in your notes, I just simply said, pride goes before a fall, because it's parallel poetry and wisdom, and they're both the same. He's saying the same thing twice. Pride goes before the fall. And I think that's what is happening with Elijah. I really believe that he displayed a sense of pride, or the sense that, wow, look at me. And I see that in how he spoke to the Baal prophets. You know, when you're in a position of confidence and faith, you don't have to rub it into anybody's nose, right? But the Baal prophets, he said, hey, keep dancing, keep shouting. Maybe your gods are taking a nap, right? What do you call that? In football, they call that taunting. And if you taunt someone and you're a Kansas City Chief and you're taunting a San Francisco 49er, guess what you're going to get? A flag. You're going to get a penalty. And so there's an evidence of pride, I think, in that posture. I really do. And then his statements in verse 10 and verse 14 of our story here is that he said, I've been very zealous for the Lord God of my life. I have been very, and I am all alone. You see, he's pretty much riveted on himself. And he has a sense of pride and self-pity at the same time. And so I see him as being susceptible to the statement, pride goes before the fall. Because when this thing comes into his life in a moment's notice, he bites the dust. I mean, he's flooded with fear. Verse 3, Elijah was afraid and he ran for his life. It's really kind of shocking in so many ways compared to what we know about Elijah. But there it is. He demonstrates something that I'm calling human default. That is something that can trigger in our lives that we're susceptible to. And the first thing that I notice is fear and foe. Fear and foe. This fear because of foe. And the idea is that this Jezebel is definitely a foe in his life. And it's a scary foe. I mean, she must have had power. 450 prophets of Baal did not shake Elijah, but this one lady did. And so it's kind of surprising when you compare 450 prophets, boom, strong, and one devilish woman. I think God's big enough for one devilish woman. What about you? But Elijah didn't. He was really taken by this whole thing, and it got inside. It got underneath his skin, and he felt insecure and fearful. And that's sort of a lesson for us. We can realize that we can be susceptible in some ways in our lives where, whoa, all of a sudden we feel incredibly anxious or very afraid or so discouraged. And it just comes on because of a trigger event. I remember being with my grandson Josiah. He's born to my daughter Carissa. And he was 3 years old about a half a year ago. And we were watching him and everything. And Josiah is very curious, rambunctious, normal three-year-old. And he was on the couch, and I was sort of just there with him, really. And he wasn't sitting still or anything. And I said, you better sit still. And he didn't. And he jumped and he tripped or something off the couch. And he, without his hands out like this, he landed face first on our coffee table. That go, boom, just like that. Boom. And it just hit that. And he goes, wah! Like that. He was really, it looked terrible to me. Terrible to me. So he's going, wah! And what is his baba doing? Wah! It's crazy. Oh, no. Oh, no. Are you okay, Joseph? Are you okay? Here comes my wife running in. She goes, quiet down. Quiet down. You know who she's talking to? Me. You're making him upset. You're making it worse than it is. And I am feeling so fearful that my grandson has had a concussion. I thought there was going to be blood gushing all over everywhere. 2 minutes later, he's back playing. Anyway, it was a trigger event. Why would I react so intensely like that? Well, I don't exactly know. Maybe that I love him and I don't want him to get hurt, but maybe when I was 3 years old and my uncle put me in a red wagon and he pushed me down a hill, and as I came to the bottom of the hill all by myself in a red wagon, and I abruptly stopped at a barbed wire fence right here, and 21 stitches later and 1/4 of an inch from my jugular vein, it was a rather traumatic event. And I don't even remember very much about it and all. I've been filled in, but could that be something? Oh, that can't be it. Are you sure? You see, things can kind of trigger us where we feel like we're not as stable in our faith. We think we are, but we're not. And boom, all of a sudden we're mad, angry, fearful. Well, that's what happened to Elijah anyway. You can see it so intense there. And so I read something that I thought was kind of interesting. Maybe you will too. It comes from the Greek Old Testament. The Greek Old Testament is called the Septuagint. In the Septuagint, there are some additional words to what Jezebel says. And here are the words. It goes like this. As surely as you are Elijah and I am Jezebel. Right there in verse 2, just added to the text, as sure as you are Elijah and I am Jezebel, may the gods deal with me if be it ever, that verb, right there. That's where it's added in the Septuagint. And you might say, well, that's an addition. But the comparison there is very interesting, because what's happening right here in this comparison is that Jezebel is pitting herself against Elijah. It's like, hey, I'm gonna be stronger than you. And so just think about this. Jezebel's name means not exalted. Not exalted. And is associated with Baal. She's like the goddess of the those prophets and stuff like that. She's a human being, but okay? And she pitted herself against Elijah. You know what his name means? Yahweh is God. So which side do you want to be on? God wins, right? Not this time. Elijah says, oh, this is too big for God, and he runs. And that is so interesting to me that he is in such a vulnerable place. And you know why? Because fear and forget go together. Fear and forget go together. You see, he forgot what he believed to be true. His perspective, his memory was short-circuited. Our superhero has lost his way. It's like Jezebel is kryptonite to him, and he can't do anything. And it's as surprising as it is, it's really something interesting to realize that I see that Elijah overreacted. He overreacted, honestly, because Jezebel, she's the queen, and she could get 50 soldiers to surround Elijah, not tell him about it, surprise attack, ambush, boom, and he's a goner. But she sends a messenger, right? So she's afraid to kill him too. Really, she is. And he doesn't think through it. His thoughts are so distorted. He's forgetting what is true. Self-pity has taken over, and he thinks he's all alone. But he knows better. Do you know he knows better? Because there's this prophet named Obadiah. And Obadiah was a courageous prophet, amazingly courageous. And he told Elijah directly in chapter 18 what he did. And here are his words. I think they're on the screen too. And they go like this. Haven't you heard, my Lord? He's talking to Elijah. Obadiah, what a hero. Now this is a hero because he's risking his life. Haven't you heard, my Lord, what I did while Jezebel was killing the prophets of the Lord? I hid 100 of the Lord's prophets in 2 caves, 50 in each, and supplied them with food and water. Obadiah risked his life. What an incredible example. Will Elijah do the same? No way. You see, that's so interesting to me. He already knew that he wasn't alone, but he thought he was alone. You see, he's really stuck. And when something positive could possibly be entering his mind, reshaping how he's looking at things, he doesn't take it in. It's like it just bounces off. Because he had the positive reality that he wasn't alone. He had the assurance that God was on his side. He could think things like, God is up to something good for me. But he didn't think that way. And so he was sort of stuck. And he was so stuck that he said the same thing in verse 10 and verse 14. His same kind of complaint is in verse 10 and 14. And I see that as well. You know, our thinking and perception can be just like Elijah's. It can really throw us off. We can believe a lie. We can actually believe that criticism is really how we should view ourselves. And we can get, things can get under our skin, and it can be really a part of what the devil wants to do in your life to bring you kind of down and in disarray, just like Elijah was. So that makes complete sense, and I want you to be aware of that. But there's another thing that happens about fear. Fear and alone. Elijah was all alone. In fact, he purposefully wanted to be alone. He told his servant to stay. In verse 3, stay. I'm going alone. I'm just gonna go and just, you know, sit under a broom tree and hopefully die. So he's all alone. And when we're alone, you know, the idea is we don't think very well when we're alone and isolated. It actually can get worse, as it did for Elijah. Now, in verse 8, there's something very interesting in verse 8. It says that he traveled 40 days and 40 nights to Mount Sinai, to Horeb. Now, listen to me. This south of Beersheba, a little bit, is where he was. And he made the rest of the way to Mount Sinai a 12-day trip. 12 days, 40 days. 40 days, 12 days. You see, he didn't go very fast. In fact, he was sort of meandering. In fact, he probably didn't even want to go there. But finally, something, maybe just a little glimmer of light or something, he went there. And that's when stuff begins to unfold, as we read in verse 9 and into verse 10. And so being alone, the correlation about being alone and our emotional health it brings it down. It affects our emotional health. It's negative, all right? So fear. We got fear and the foe. We got fear and forgetting what's true. And we got fear and being isolated and all alone. And this is Elijah's story. And if it's your story, you're probably feeling a lot like Elijah. But I have good news for you. Isn't it great that this story has a divine side to it? And I call it divine download. That's what I call it, divine download. And it's this heart of God to restore Elijah, restore us. This download is that I need some new stuff in my files. The download into my, I need some racing going on too when I'm in a place like Elijah. I need some racing, but I need a download. And this is what I see happening here, erasing and replacing. And this is the renewal of faith in God. Elijah, that's what he needs. He needs this very, very much so. Faith, a renewal of faith in God. His discouragement, his will, his desire to give up and everything, boom. God overlooks that and pursues this guy. And it's so surprising to me. You know, Elijah was very low, we can tell, pretty low. And he's under a broom tree and he's sweating and he wants to die and everything. He's the kind of guy that you kind of go, just let him to himself, you know, and avoid. But not our God. Our God isn't like that. I might be like that at times, but God is not like that. He pursues this discouraged man. He brings an angel. This is his initiative. Angels don't go anywhere on their own. They're told to go someplace, and they go, and they're sent as messengers from God. And he comes twice to Elijah. Doesn't seem to affect his heart much, but he comes twice. And that is the pursuit of God. Now, we read in verse 4 that Elijah prayed, but what he prayed isn't what God answered, you know? Thank goodness, because he prayed to die. But God was responding to even a prayer like that. And what does God do? He says, "What are you doing here, Elijah?" Isn't that an interesting question? Do you think God was confused? Oh, I wonder what Elijah's doing here. No, God asks questions with a purpose behind it. He asks me questions all the time, and he already knows the answer. But he wants me to think about it. And God wanted Elijah to think about what's going on. So he asked this question in verse 9, and he asked the same question in verse 13. It reminds me of how, like, Jesus, with Peter. Peter had denied him 3 times. And what did the Lord do when he met up with Peter? He said, "Peter, do you love me?" "Well, Lord, you know I love you." "Peter, do you love me?" He asked it again. And Peter said, "Lord, you know that I love you. Lord, you know that I love you." So Jesus wasn't asking a question that he was kind of going, "Oh, I wonder what the answer is here." And the same with Elijah. And in both times, I'm so surprised there's no sense of condemnation. The Lord is not critical of Elijah. I'm critical of Elijah. He sort of scares me by his behavior, but not God. God is not angry. He's not ready to punish. It is just an amazing picture of our God. I just love that part about God. So I think that's so neat. So as I'm thinking about, you know, God's activity, there's a high point here, a really beautiful point. And it's all culminated. Elijah was used to the spectacular. I mean, the wind wouldn't shake him up, and earthquake and fire and all. He's seen all that stuff. But here you have something unique and beautiful. And it's in verse 12. And it says, "After the fire came a gentle whisper." A gentle whisper. And this gentle whisper is sometimes translated a still small voice. Whatever the translation, even the sound of silence is one of the translations. It's really hard. It is this amazing kind of the wind of God, the presence of God, the closeness with God. And here's Elijah in the cave, and he comes out. I heard that. And he covers his face with the cloak because he knows now he's in the special presence of God. And I think this is the moment. Even though he says the same things, I think he says it differently. And then things begin to transition. This is the point where really something special happens. Well, I was on my trip to Minnesota, celebrating my mother's 90th birthday. I had a time then during that trip that I felt very discouraged, heavy-hearted, just burdened. And it's hard to see your dad get old and frail and then not being able to connect and stuff. That's really hard. And that was a part of the dynamic to see that, will I get to see my dad again, that kind of thing. And then visiting with my relatives are basically Lutheran, and now they're, you know, hardly even Lutheran because they are questioning. I talked to several of them. I don't know if you can trust the Bible. You know, and is really, you think there's something like heaven? Yes, yes I do. I'm counting on it and stuff like that. And I don't know. I've prayed to God, and I don't think it really has worked. Stuff like that, those kind of conversations. And I don't come on like, you know, well, you're going to hell, you know. I want to make connection. I don't live there, so I'm trying to. And it's sad. It's just sad that the decline of even a basic faith is just crumbling. And I'm in the car. I'm running an errand. I'm in my parents' car. I'm by myself, and I'm feeling the weight of this. And I'm feeling like, oh, this is so sad. This is what I've given my life for, and these people around me that are related to me by blood are just crumbling. And I'm driving along, and I have the Christian radio program on in the area, and I'm driving, and I put my hand on my heart. I say, God, this is really bumming me out. And as I am there just praying, and a song is on the radio, and I'm done. After I'm sensing God doing his marvelous touch of the Spirit in my life, I go, what song was that? I couldn't remember. And it made all the difference. I'm telling you, it made all the difference. It was like these situations, my dad, the people are in God's hands. And I just surrendered. And it was really sweet. And it made a huge difference. See, renewal in my faith in God. I was losing some, just a marginal, small, but significant enough to make me feel burdened, like, God, you where are you in this deal? And it renewed my faith. There's something else in this story that is really equally, well, not equally, but along with it, very important. And it's the renewal of faith in others. Renewal of faith in others. And that happens. And this is God's plan. You see, Elijah was sort of a loner. If you read his story, he's kind of going around doing his thing as a prophet, and he's pretty much alone. And he really is alone in our story, and he makes that like part of his desire to be alone. Well, the Lord says, in so many words, we're done with that. I don't want you to be alone anymore. I got a guy. He's going to be your companion. It's going to be just what you need. His name is Elisha. Elijah, you're going to connect with Elisha, and you guys are going to be buddies. And you're going to help him because you've been along the journey longer, and you're going to have a companionship with him, and then he's going to do what you have been doing. And that's really so fascinating to me. And you know, in verse 19, Elijah does just what God asked him to do, and he goes and he meets with Elisha. And you know what he does? He takes that really special cloak that he put over his face in the mouth of the cave. You know what he does with that cloak? He takes that cloak and he puts it over Elisha. Just when he meets Elisha, he puts it over Elisha. Whoa, you know, the experience that I had with God, Elisha, it's going to be on you. It's going to be on you. We're going to share this together, and then you're going to be released to do what God has called you to do. Very cool to see this companionship and this redirection that God had in mind for Elijah. Maybe you're a loner. Maybe you try to do too much just yourself. You know, God never intended you to do it that way. He intended you to rub up next to others and talk and do life and share, listen and care. There was this quote from a book that I read in the past, Randy Frazee, in a book called Making Room for Life. And this particular paragraph was especially profound to me. Here it is. In reality, it's possible to be in the company of others and still feel isolated. Community specialists call this brand of isolation experienced by the majority of Americans as crowded loneliness. It's the most dangerous loneliness of all because it emits a false air of community that prevents us from diagnosing our dilemma correctly. We have exposure to people, but not a deep connection to people. The truth is that there is a huge gap between God's original design for connection and the way most of us live our lives. Over the last 50 to 75 years, Americans have never understood this design requirement or have downgraded it to an optional amenity. We must dissolve that gap and close it, or we will continue to struggle, suffer, and would I even dare to suggest, die before our time. Now that's a strong quote, and I wanted it to be strong for us to think about, because friendship, connection, and shared life with others is so closely tied to your emotional well-being, to my emotional well-being. It's the way God meant us to do our faith journey in community with other people. So God directs Elijah to Elisha, and he renews his faith in himself. God renews faith in himself. Elijah needed a renewal, not for the idea of self-centeredness or pride or anything like that. He needed to realize that God still had plans for him. He had a purpose in mind. And all the direction that God gives him is things for him to do. And so after the whisper of God, you know, calling him out, there is this word in verse 15, go, go. And you get that word. Go back to where you ran from. Go back. Go back and face your fears. Go back and connect with these men that I'm going to use, Hezekiah and Jehu and Elisha. Go do it. This is what I want you to do. You're my ambassador. You have a message to give. I want you to call out these guys and really affirm them that God has a plan for them. And here it is. This is a very important calling, because God was going to fulfill his plans through Hezekiah and Jehu and Elisha, and Elijah was going to initiate it, and he was going to connect, and he was going to affirm, this is the word of the Lord to you. He was going to be a prophet relationally with these people, and it was really cool. You see, he had been stuck in fear and self-pity, and now he moves towards helping. That helps us, doesn't it? When we're moved towards helping people, it helps us. We get out of our fear and self-pity when we begin to think about others. There's been studies about the Nazi death camps, and the study went like this. Those that focused their energies on helping people around them were much more likely to survive than those who allowed themselves to simply be victims. God is re-enlisting Elijah. He has a call on his life, and Elijah says yes, he goes. I was reading a book for some of the ministry of seniors here at our church. It's called Aging Well, and it's a long book of statistics and findings about aging. But you'll not be surprised by this. One of the key ingredients to aging well is to continue to live with a sense of purpose. And so we know that when people lose their purpose and they're older than me or my age, they will shrink fast. So purpose. Now, I know you understand this. As a follower of Jesus Christ, you have a purpose to represent him until you breathe your last breath. And how you represent him might change, might shift. There might be different ways that you represent him as you go through your journey of life. Just like Elijah, he was doing the miraculous. Now he's going to pass on and be the affirmer. He's going to be the ambassador for the Lord. That's going to be different than the prophet, all right? Well, think in those terms, all right? Just the idea that helping others, serving others, having a purpose, other-centered, will keep you well, much better than self-centered, overthinking, and losing perspective. So here it is, overcoming fear by faith. Overcoming fear by faith, God's heart to restore. That's God's heart. And that's the picture of God we have in this story, God's heart to restore. Renewed faith in God, renewed faith in our closeness with others, a renewed faith in our sense of purpose to serve and bless people around us. That'll really overcome fear by faith. There's this amazing thing in creation. It's called the Amazon River. It's really something. The Amazon River at the mouth of the Amazon River, it's 90 miles wide, 90 miles wide. And the combination of the Mississippi and the Yangtze and the Nile rivers don't even equal the flow of the Amazon River. Altogether, they don't even equal the flow. And the Amazon River, it is said, the current of the Amazon River can be detected out into the South Atlantic Ocean for 200 miles. 200 miles. Well, it was in years past during ancient navigation that sometimes ships would become adrift in the windless waters of the South Atlantic. And they would be there for weeks and really in a difficult, distressed position. When a ship would be viewed that would be coming into their waters, the distressed ship would quickly get a distress signal out. We are stuck and thirsting to death. That would be their signal. And the ship that understood the location and the dynamics and everything would quickly signal back, lower your buckets. You are in the mighty mouth of the Amazon River. And I think many times when we're adrift, stuck, overwhelmed by this and that, that we forget how close God is. We forget that right here and now, right in this moment's time, in a car with a song and your hand on your heart, God is there. And so if you're adrift, I just have one request of you. Lower your buckets. You're in the mighty presence of the Spirit of the living God. And if you listen carefully, you'll hear God.